no worse, the proofs of another's friendship making all the more cruel those of her indifference. I transferred my hopes to the afternoon post. Even between the times at which letters were delivered, I dare not leave the house, for she might be sending hers by a messenger. Then, the time coming at last, when neither the postman nor a footman from the Swans could possibly appear that night, I must procrastinate my hopes of being set at rest. And thus, because I believed that my sufferings were not destined to last, I was obliged, so to speak, incessantly to renew them. My disappointment was perhaps the same, but instead of just uniformly prolonging, as in the old days, an initial emotion, it began again several times daily, starting each time with an emotion so frequently renewed that it ended, it so purely physical, so instantaneous a state, by becoming stabilized, so consistently that the strain of waiting, having hardly time to relax before a fresh reason for waiting supervened, there was no longer a single minute in the day in which I was not in that state of anxiety which it is so difficult to bear even for an hour. So my punishment was infinitely more cruel than in those New Year holidays long ago, because this time there was in me, instead of the acceptance pure and simple of that punishment, the hope at every moment of seeing it come to an end. And yet, at this state of acceptance, I ultimately arrived. Then I understood that it must be final, and I renounced Gilberte forever, in the interests of my love itself, and because I hoped above all that she would not retain any contemptuous memory of me. Indeed, from that moment, so that she should not be led to suppose any sort of lover's spite on my part, when she made appointments for me to see her, I used often to accept them, and then at the last moment write to her that I was prevented from coming. But with the same protestations of my disappointment that I should have made to anyone whom I had not wished to see. These expressions of regret, which we keep as a rule for people who do not matter, would do more, I imagine, to persuade Gilberte of my indifference than would the tone of indifference which we affect only to those whom we love. When, better than by mere words, by a course of action indefinitely repeated, I should have proved to her that I had no appetite for seeing her, perhaps she would discover once again an appetite for seeing me. Alas, I was doomed to failure. To attempt, by ceasing to see her, to reawaken in her that inclination to see me, was to lose her for ever. First of all, because when it began to revive, if I wished it to last, I must not give way to it at once. Besides, the most agonizing hours would then have passed. It was at this very moment that she was indispensable to me, and I should have liked to be able to warn her that what presently she would have to assuage by the act of seeing me again would be a grief so far diminished as to be no longer, what a moment ago it would still have been, nor the thought of putting an end to it, a motive towards surrender, reconciliation, further meetings. And then again, later on, when I should at last be able safely to confess to Gilberte, so far would her liking for me have regained its strength, my liking for her, the latter, not having been able to resist the strain of so long a separation, would have ceased to exist. Gilberte would have become immaterial to me. I knew this, but I could not explain it to her. She would have assumed that if I was pretending that I should cease to love her, if I remained for too long without seeing her, that was solely in order that she might summon me back to her at once. In the meantime, what made it easier for me to sentence myself to this separation was the fact that, in order to make it quite clear to her that despite my protestations to the contrary, it was my own free will and not any conflicting engagement, not the state of my health that prevented me from seeing her, whenever I knew beforehand that Gilberte would not be in the house, was going out somewhere with a friend and would not be home for dinner, I went to see Madame Swann, who had once more become to me what she had been at the time when I had such difficulty in seeing her daughter, and, on days when the latter was not coming to the Champs-Élysées, used to repair to the Allée des Acacias. In this way, I should be hearing about Gilberte, and could be certain that she would in due course hear about me, and in terms which would show her that I was not interested in her. And I found, as all those who suffer find, that my melancholy condition might have been worse. For being free at any time to enter the habitation in which Gilberte dwelt, I constantly reminded myself, for all that I was firmly resolved to make no use of that privilege, that if ever my pain grew too sharp, there was a way of making it cease. I was not unhappy, save only from day to day, and even that is an exaggeration. How many times in an hour, but now without that anxious expectancy which had strained every nerve of me in the first weeks after our quarrel, before I had gone again to the Swans, did I not repeat to myself the words of the letter which, one day soon, Gilberte would surely send, would perhaps even bring it to me herself? The perpetual vision of that imagined happiness helped me to endure the desolation of my real happiness. With women who do not love us, as with the missing, the knowledge that there is no hope left does not prevent our continuing to wait for news. We live on tenterhooks, starting at the slightest sound. The mother whose son has gone to sea on some perilous voyage of discovery sees him in imagination every moment, long after the fact of his having perished has been established, striding into the room, saved by a miracle and in the best of health. And this strain of waiting, according to the strength of her memory and the resistance of her bodily organs, either helps her on her journey through the years, at the end of which she will be able to endure the knowledge that her son is no more, to forget gradually and to survive his loss, or else it kills her. On the other hand, my grief found consolation in the idea that my love must profit by it. Each visit that I paid to Madame Swann without seeing Gilberte was a cruel punishment, but I felt that it correspondingly enhanced the idea that Gilberte had of me. Besides, if I always took care before going to see Madame Swann that there should be no risk of her daughter's appearing, that arose, it is true, from my determination to break with her, but no less, perhaps, from that hope of reconciliation which overlay my intention to renounce her. Very few of such intentions are absolute, at least in a continuous form, in this human soul of ours, one of whose laws, confirmed by the unlooked-for wealth of illustration that memory supplies, is intermittence, and hid from me all that in it was unbearably cruel. As for that hope, I saw clearly how far it was chimerical. I was like a pauper who moistens his dry crust with fewer tears if he assures himself that at any moment a total stranger is perhaps going to leave him the whole of his fortune. We are all of us obliged, if we are to make reality endurable, to nurse a few little follies in ourselves. Now my hope remained more intact, while at the same time our separation became more effectual, if I refrained from meeting Gilberte. If I had found myself face to face with her in her mother's drawing-room, we might perhaps have uttered irrevocable words which would have rendered our breach final, killed my hope, and on the other hand, by creating a fresh anxiety, reawakened my love and made resignation harder. Ever so long ago, before I had even thought of breaking with her daughter, Madame Swann had said to me, "It is all very well your coming to see Gilberte. I should like you to come sometimes for my sake. Not to my kettle drums, which would bore you because there's such a crowd, but on the other days, when you will always find me at home if you come fairly late." So that I might be thought, when I came to see her, to be yielding only after a long resistance to a desire which she had expressed in the past. And very late in the afternoon, when it was quite dark, almost at the hour at which my parents would be sitting down to dinner, I would set out to pay Madame Swann a visit, in the course of which I knew that I should not see Gilberte, and yet should be thinking only of her. In that quarter, then looked upon as remote, of a Paris darker than Paris is today, where even in the centre there was no electric light in the public thoroughfares and very little in private houses, the lamps of a drawing-room situated on the ground level, or but slightly raised above it, as were the rooms in which Madame Swann generally received her visitors, were enough to lighten the street and to make the passer-by raise his eyes, connecting with their glow, as with its apparent, though hidden, cause, the presence outside the door of a string of smart brooms. This passer-by was led to believe, not without a certain emotion, that a modification had been effected in this mysterious cause, when he saw one of the carriages begin to move. But it was merely a coachman who, afraid of his horses catching cold, started them now and again on a brisk walk, all the more impressive because the rubber-tired wheels gave the sound of their hooves a background of silence from which it stood out more distinct and more explicit. The winter garden, of which in those days the passer-by generally caught a glimpse in whatever street he might be walking, if the drawing-room did not stand too high above the pavement, is to be seen today only in photogravures in the gift-books of P.J. Stahl, where, in contrast to the infrequent floral decorations of the Louis XVI drawing-rooms now in fashion, a single rose or a Japanese iris in a long-necked vase of crystal into which it would be impossible to squeeze a second, it seems because of the profusion of indoor plants which people had then, and of the absolute want of style in their arrangement, as though it must have responded in the ladies whose houses it adorned to some living and delicious passion for botany, rather than to any cold concern for lifeless decoration. It suggested to one, only on a larger scale, in the houses of those days, those tiny portable hothouses laid out on New Year's morning beneath the lighted lamp, for the children were always too impatient to wait for daylight, among all the other New Year's presents, but the loveliest of them all, consoling them with its real plants, which they could tend as they grew, for the bareness of the winter soil, and even more than those little houses themselves, those winter gardens were like the hothouse that the children could see there at the same time, portrayed in a delightful book, another of their presents, and one which, for all that it was given not to them but to Mademoiselle Lily, the heroine of the story, enchanted them to such a pitch that even now, when they're almost old men and women, they ask themselves whether in those fortunate years winter was not the loveliest of the seasons. And inside there, beyond the winter garden, through the various kinds of arborescence which from the street made the lighted window appear like the glass front of one of those children's playthings, pictured or real, the passer-by, drawing himself up on tiptoe, would generally observe a man in a frock coat, a gardenia or a carnation in his buttonhole, standing before a seated lady, both vaguely outlined, like two intaglios cut in a topaz, in the depths of the drawing-room atmosphere clouded by the samovar, then a recent importation, with steam which may very possibly be escaping from it still today, but to which, if it does, we are grown so accustomed now that no one notices it. Madame Swann attached great importance to her tea. She thought that she showed her originality and expressed her charm when she said to a man, "You will find me at home any day fairly late. Come to tea." So that she allowed a sweet and delicate smile to accompany the words which she pronounced with a fleeting trace of English accent, and which her listener duly noted, bowing solemnly in acceptance, as though the invitation had been something important and uncommon, which commanded deference and required attention. There was another reason, apart from those given already, for the flowers having more than a merely ornamental part in Madame Swann's drawing-room. And this reason pertained not to the period, but in some degree to the former life of Odette. A great courtesan, such as she had been, lives largely for her lovers, that is to say, at home, which means that she comes in time to live for her home. The things that one sees in the house of a respectable woman, things which may of course appear to her also to be of importance, are those which are in any event of the utmost importance to the courtesan. The culminating point of her day is not the moment in which she dresses herself for all the world to see, but that in which she undresses herself for a man. She must be as smart in her wrapper, in her nightgown, as in her outdoor attire. Other women display their jewels, but as for her, she lives in the intimacy of her pearls. This kind of existence imposes on her as an obligation and ends by giving her a fondness for luxury which is secret, that is to say, which comes near to being disinterested. Madame Swann extended this to include her flowers. There was always beside her chair an immense bowl of crystal filled to the brim with Parma violets, or with long white daisy petals scattered upon the water, which seemed to be testifying in the eyes of the arriving guest to some favourite and interrupted occupation, such as the cup of tea which Madame Swann would, for her own amusement, have been drinking there by herself. An occupation more intimate still and more mysterious, so much so that one felt oneself impelled to apologize on seeing the flowers exposed there by her side, as one would have apologized for looking at the title of the still open book, which would have revealed to one what had just been read by, and so perhaps what was still in the mind of, Odette. And unlike the book, the flowers were living things. It was annoying, when one entered the room to pay Madame Swann a visit, to discover that she was not alone, or if one came home with her, not to find the room empty, so prominent a place in it, enigmatic and intimately associated with hours in the life of their mistress, of which one knew nothing, did those flowers assume, which had not been made ready for Odette's visitors, but, as it were, forgotten there by her, had held, and would hold with her again, private conversations which one was afraid of disturbing, the secret of which one tried in vain to read, fastening one's eyes on the moist purple, the still liquid watercolour of the Parma violets. By the end of October, Odette would begin to come home with the utmost punctuality for tea, which was still known at that time as 5 o'clock tea, having once heard it said, and being fond of repeating that if Madame Verdurin had been able to form a salon, it was because people were always certain of finding her at home at the same hour. She imagined that she herself had one also of the same kind, but freer, senza rigore, as she used to say. She saw herself figuring thus as a sort of l'espinasse, and believed that she had founded a rival salon by taking from the du deffant of the little group several of her most attractive men, notably Swann himself, who had followed her in her succession and into her retirement, according to a version for which one can understand that she had succeeded in gaining credit among her more recent friends, ignorant of what had passed, though without convincing herself. But certain favourite parts are played by us so often before the public, and rehearsed so carefully when we are alone, that we find it easier to refer to their fictitious testimony than to that of a reality which we have almost entirely forgotten. On days on which Madame Swann had not left the house, one found her in a wrapper of crêpe de chine, white as the first snows of winter, or it might be in one of those long pleated garments of mousset de soie, which seemed nothing more than a shower of white or rosy petals, and would be regarded today as hardly suitable for winter, though quite wrongly. For these light fabrics and soft colours gave to a woman, in the stifling warmth of the drawing-rooms of those days, with their heavily curtained doors, rooms of which the most effective thing that the society novelists of the time could find to say was that they were exquisitely cushioned. The same air of coolness that they gave to the roses, which were able to stay in the room there by her side, despite the winter, in the glowing flesh tints of their nudity, as though it were already spring. By reason of the muffling of all sound in the carpets, and of the remoteness of her cosy retreat, the lady of the house, not being apprised of your entry as she is today, would continue to read almost until you were standing before her chair, which enhanced still further that sense of the romantic, that charm of a sort of secret discovery, which we find today in the memory of those gowns, already out of fashion even then, which Madame Swann was perhaps alone in not having discarded, and which give us the feeling that the woman who wore them must have been the heroine of a novel, because most of us have scarcely set eyes on them outside the pages of certain of Henri Grévieux's tales. Odette had at this time in her drawing-room, when winter began, chrysanthemums of enormous size and a variety of colours, such as Swann in the old days certainly never saw in her drawing-room in the Rue La Pérouse. My admiration for them, when I went to pay Madame Swann one of those melancholy visits, during which, prompted by my sorrow, I discovered in her all the mystical poetry of her character as the mother of that Gilberte to whom she would say on the morrow, "Your friend came to see me yesterday," sprang, no doubt, from my sense that rose-pale like the Louis XIV silk that covered her chairs, snow-white like her crepe de chine wrapper, or of a metallic red like her samovar, they superimposed upon the decoration of the room another, a supplementary scheme of decoration, as rich, as delicate in its colouring, but one which was alive and would last for a few days only. But I was touched to find that these chrysanthemums appeared less ephemeral than, one might say, lasting, when I compared them with the tones as pink, as coppery, which the setting sun so gorgeously displays amid the mists of a November afternoon, and which, after seeing them before I had entered the house, fade from the sky, I found again inside, prolonged, transposed onto the flaming palette of the flowers, like the fires caught and fixed by a great colourist from the impermanence of the atmosphere and the sun, so that they should enter and adorn a human dwelling. They invited me, those chrysanthemums, to put away all my sorrows, and to taste with a greedy rapture during that tea-time the two fleeting joys of November, of which they set ablaze all around me the intimate and mystical glory. Alas, it was not in the conversations to which I must listen that I could hope to attain to that glory. They had but little in common with it. Even with Madame Cottard, and although it was growing late, Madame Swann would assume the most caressing manner to say, "Oh, no, it's not late, really. You mustn't look at the clock. That's not the right time. It's stopped. You can't possibly have anything else to do now. Why be in such a hurry?" As she pressed a final tartlet upon the professor's wife, who was gripping her card-case in readiness for flight. "One simply can't tear oneself away from this house," observed Madame Bontemps to Madame Swann, while Madame Cottard, in her astonishment at hearing her own thoughts put into words, exclaimed, "Why, that's just what I always say myself, what I tell my own little judge in the court of conscience," winning the applause of the gentlemen from the jockey club, who had been profuse in their salutations, as though confounded at such an honour's being done them, when Madame Swann had introduced them to this common and by no means attractive little woman, who kept herself, when confronted with Odette's brilliant friends, in reserve, if not on what she herself called the defensive, for she always used stately language to describe the simplest happenings.
"I should never have suspected it," was Madame Swann's comment. "Three Wednesdays running you've played me false."
That's quite true, Odette. It's simply ages. It's an eternity since I saw you last. You see, I plead guilty, but I must tell you, she went on with a vague suggestion of outraged modesty, for although a doctor's wife, she would never have dared to speak without periphrasis of rheumatism or of a chill on the kidneys.
That I've had a lot of little troubles, as we all have, I dare say. And besides, that I've had a crisis among my masculine domestics. I'm sure I'm no more imbued with a sense of my own authority than most ladies. Still, I've been obliged, just to make an example, you know, to give my Vatel notice. I believe he was looking out anyhow for a more remunerative place, but his departure nearly brought about the resignation of my entire ministry. My own maid refused to stay in the house a moment longer. Oh, we've had some Homeric scenes. However, I held fast to the reins through thick and thin. The whole affair's been a perfect lesson, which won't be lost on me, I can tell you. I'm afraid I'm boring you with all these stories about servants, but you know as well as I do what a business it is when one is obliged to set about rearranging one's household. "Aren't we to see anything of your delicious child?" she wound up. "No, my delicious child is dining with a friend," replied Madame Swann, and then turning to me, "I believe she's written to you, asking you to come and see her tomorrow. And your babies?"
she went on to Madame Cottard. I breathed a sigh of relief. These words, by which Madame Swann proved to me that I could see Gilberte whenever I chose, gave me precisely the comfort which I had come to seek, and which at that time made my visits to Madame Swann so necessary. "No, I'm afraid not. I shall write to her anyhow this evening. Gilberte and I never seem to see one another now," I added, pretending to attribute our separation to some mysterious agency which gave me a further illusion of being in love, supported as well by the affectionate way in which I spoke of Gilberte and she of me.
"You know, she's simply devoted to you," said Madame Swann. "Really, you won't come tomorrow?"
Suddenly my heart rose on wings. The thought had just struck me. After all, why shouldn't I, since it's her own mother who suggests it? But with the thought, I fell back into my old depression. I was afraid now lest, when she saw me again, Gilberte might think that my indifference of late had been feigned, and it seemed wiser to prolong our separation. During these asides, Madame Bonton had been complaining of the insufferable dullness of politicians' wives, for she pretended to find everyone too deadly or too stupid for words, and to deplore her husband's official position.
"Do you mean to say you can shake hands with 50 doctors' wives like that, one after the other?" she exclaimed to Madame Cottard, who, unlike her, was full of the kindest feelings for everybody and of determination to do her duty in every respect. "Ah, you're a law-abiding woman. You see, in my case at the ministry, don't you know, I simply have to keep it up, of course. It's too much for me, I can tell you. You know what those officials' wives are like. It's all I can do not to put my tongue out at them. And my niece Albertine is just like me. You really wouldn't believe the impudence that girl has. Last week, on my day, I had the wife of the Under Secretary of State for Finance, who told us that she knew nothing at all about cooking. 'But surely, ma'am,' my niece chipped in with her most winning smile, 'you ought to know everything about it, after all the dishes your father had to wash.'
Oh, I do love that story. I think it's simply exquisite," cried Madame Swann.
"But certainly on the doctor's consultation days you should make a point of being at home among your flowers and books and all your pretty things," she urged Madame Cottard. "Straight out like that, bang, right in the face, bang. She made no bones about it, I can tell you. And she never said a word to me about it, the little wretch. She's as cunning as a monkey. You're lucky to be able to control yourself. I do envy people who can hide what is in their minds.
But I've no need to do that, Madame Bontemps. I'm not so hard to please,
Madame Cottard gently expostulated.
For one thing, I'm not in such a privileged position,
she went on, slightly raising her voice as was her custom, as though she were underlining the point of her remark whenever she slipped into the conversation any of those delicate courtesies, those skilful flatteries which won her the admiration and assisted the career of her husband.
And besides, I'm only too glad to do anything that can be of use to the professor.
But, my dear, it isn't what one's glad to do. It's what one's able to do. I expect you're not nervous. Do you know, whenever I see the war minister's wife making faces, I start copying her at once. It's a dreadful thing to have a temperament like mine.
Oh, to be sure, yes, said Madame Cottard. I've heard people say that she had a twitch. My husband knows someone else who occupies a very high position, and it's only natural when gentlemen get talking together.
And then, don't you know, it's just the same with the chief of the registry. He's a hunchback. Whenever he comes to see me, before he's been in the room 5 minutes, my fingers are itching to stroke his hump. My husband says I'll cost him his place.
What if I do? A fig for the ministry.
Yes, a fig for the ministry. I should like to have that printed as a motto on my notepaper. I can see I am shocking you. You're so frightfully proper. But I must say there's nothing amuses me like a little devilry now and then. Life would be dreadfully monotonous without it.
And she went on talking about the ministry all the time, as though it had been Mount Olympus. To change the conversation, Madame Swann turned to Madame Cottard.
But you're looking very smart today. Red fern, fake it?
No, you know, I always swear by Rautnitz. Besides, it's only an old thing that I've had done up.
Not really. It's charming.
Guess how much?
No, change the first figure.
You don't say so. Why, that's nothing. It's given away. 3 times that at least, I should have said.
You see how history comes to be written,
apostrophized the doctor's wife, and pointing to a neck ribbon which had been a present from Madame Swann.
Look, Odette, do you recognize this?
Through the gap between a pair of curtains, a head peeped with ceremonious deference, making a playful pretense of being afraid of disturbing the party. It was Swann.
Odette, the Prince d'Argigent is with me in the study. He wants to know if he may pay his respects to you. What am I to tell him?
Why, that I shall be delighted.
Odette would reply, secretly flattered, but without losing anything of the composure which came to her all the more easily, since she had always, even in her fast days, been accustomed to entertain men of fashion. Swann disappeared to deliver the message, and would presently return with the prince, unless in the meantime Madame Verdurin had arrived. When he married Odette, Swann had insisted on her ceasing to frequent the little clan. He had several good reasons for this stipulation, though had he had none, he would have made it just the same, in obedience to a law of ingratitude which admits no exception and proves that every go-between is either lacking in foresight or else singularly disinterested. He had conceded only that Odette and Madame Verdurin might exchange visits once a year, and even this seemed excessive to some of the faithful, indignant at the insult offered to the mistress, who for so many years had treated Odette and even Swann himself as the spoiled children of her house. For if it contained false brethren who failed upon certain evenings, in order that they might secretly accept an invitation from Odette, ready, in the event of discovery, with the excuse that they were anxious to meet Bergotte, although the mistress assured them that he never went to the Swans, and even if he did, had no vestige of talent, really.
in spite of which she was making the most strenuous efforts to quote one of her favourite expressions to attract him. The little group had its diehards also. And these, though ignorant of those conventional refinements which often dissuade people from the extreme attitude one would have liked to see them adopt in order to annoy someone else, would have wished Madame Verdurin, but had never managed to prevail upon her, to sever all connection with Odette, and thus deprive Odette of the satisfaction of saying with a mocking laugh,
"We go to the mistress's very seldom now, since the schism. It was all very well while my husband was still a bachelor, but when one is married, you know, it isn't always so easy. If you must know, Monsieur Swann can't abide old Ma Verdurin, and he wouldn't much like the idea of my going there regularly as I used to. And I, as a dutiful spouse, don't you see?"
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.